Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Peter Murta, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Peter, people know you as an Irish Times journalist, now retired. And look, for some people, it's gardening or golf or whatever. Your idea of kicking back in retirement was an 8-month journey by motorbike from Chile to Alaska. So I suppose my first very basic question is why?
I suppose to see if I could do it. The most simple answer. I'm kind of adventurous in my outlook. I love travel. I love going places. I particularly like going places that I haven't been before to see what they're like, and wandering about and meeting people and looking at everything that's to be seen. I also like biking. I've been riding this type of motorbike since my mid-50s.
It's a bit of a monster, the bike.
It's a bit of a monster, yeah. It's a 1200cc, and it is the bike for, you know, going around the world. It's a BMW R1200 GS, so it's a big bike. And I wanted to do a big journey, and I wanted to do it on my own, so that my mind was focused on where I was and what I was seeing and the people I was meeting. And, you know, there are only so many of those really big journeys on the planet that you can do. I didn't want to do it in Africa. Going right the way across Europe and into Russia and over to the Far East has all sorts of difficulties. So going right through the Americas was what I latched onto. And while a lot of people, or some people, fair number of people, do it from north to south, I thought, well, I'll do it the other way around. I'll do it uphill. I'll go from the south to the north.
And it's called the Trans-America Highway, is it?
There's a road.
It's not really like
There's a road called the Pan-American Highway on the western side, the Pacific side of South America. It's not really one road. You know, in parts of Chile, it's signposted as the Pan-American Highway, and parts of Peru. I didn't stick to it. I went wandering off-piste as the mood took me.
Some very hairy roads. There were barely roads sometimes, weren't there?
There were one or two, all right. Yeah, there were parts of... There's a famous road in Argentina called Route 40. That became gravel at times. And there's another very famous one in southern Chile called the Carretera Austral, which is a stunning, amazing road on the western Andes. And some of that is gravel. And then in Colombia, I kind of got misdirected and ended up in a jungle area in the northwestern part of the country. And the road got narrower and narrower and narrower and higher and higher, and until it was really like a riverbed. And I was quite worried at that point, because I couldn't turn the bike around. It was so narrow and it was so rocky, and I just had to keep going.
Yeah, so you've written a book, From Tip to Top, The Journey of a Lifetime from Chile to Alaska. Mm. And it's interesting you say worried. Reading the book, I was worried for you at times.
I'm grand, like, Brendan, thank you.
I know, but you're no spring chicken, but it's a demanding journey on all kinds of levels. Like, physically.
Yeah.
Like, things we mightn't think of, like, you need to be able to pick up the bike if you fall off. And it's not a given that you're able to pick up the bike. Yeah?
You do. I mean, I didn't realise how heavy it was until I was coming home, and I had to air freight the bike from Canada back to Ireland. And on the manifest, it gave a weight, and it was something 700 and something kilos. Now, that was everything. That was all my belongings, all my biking gear, everything put on a pallet. The bike itself, I think, is closer to 400. And you know, if you do fall over, and I did 3, 4, 5 times at very, very, very low speed, just trying to navigate gravel and that sort of thing. And if you lose your balance or the front wheel skews, you will topple over. You take the boxes off, you take the luggage off, and there are various tricks for lifting it. But I was pleasantly surprised that age 70, I could actually lift it.
The solitude is interesting. You admit, I think, twice in the course of the whole book, there's two particular places you are. And you admit, I miss my wife.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you obviously decided to embrace solitude.
Yeah, I'm a sort of fairly self-contained fellow. I mean, I'm very gregarious. I like people. I love my wife. I love my family. I missed her a lot.
I'm glad you made that clear, yeah.
I'm sure she is too. Not just in the two times I mentioned. And there were particular circumstances. I was in places of great natural beauty, and Moira is a painter and loves landscape and loves colour and loves light. And I was looking at things that I knew would delight her. And yes, it saddened me that I wasn't sharing that moment with her and enjoying the pleasure of it with her. But most of the time, I'm comfortable in my own skin. And when you're on your own, particularly something like biking, you don't face those choices of, well, John, shall we turn left or right? Or I fancy going to this castle and you want to go to the beach, whatever it is. You know, you just do what you want.
Exactly what you're talking about, yeah. Is there a certain, what's the feeling as well of like being out on the bike on your own in it all? Is that a certain romantic vibe, yeah?
It is, yeah, and it's hugely seductive. There's a number of aspects to it. I mean, obviously, it has its dangers. Let's not be silly about it. But apart from that, just parking that, as it were, the sense you have of being part of the landscape through which you're moving, that you don't get inside a car or a bus, for instance. You can almost you can sense the landscape. You can smell the vegetation. You can smell the farms, the agriculture. You can smell the smoke if you're in a polluted area. But you feel really, really close to where you are. And the other thing is this great sense of freedom, that you have an extraordinary sense of freedom, that I can just go down that road, or hey, what's down that one there? And you just just turn left and
Okay, I'm getting it all now, yeah. Okay, will we start at the bottom?
Okay.
South and Central America, poverty is an overwhelming thing that comes across, really. It affected you, I think, as well, didn't it?
It can be upsetting, yeah. It's not everywhere, in fairness. I mean, Chile is a very prosperous country, and the levels of inequality in Chile are a great deal less than you find elsewhere. But there were places in Central America, in Peru in particular, where it just seems so unfair. You know, the gulf, the inequality, the level of poverty. In parts of Peru, the level of environmental degradation, if you like, the level of filth, of litter, was quite extraordinary. And that's because it's not the people there any dirtier than any other people. It's because of a failure of government, that society isn't functioning well. And in Peru in particular, I came through there when there was a lot of political upheaval at the end of December, early January, and found myself in the middle of demonstrations. And the roads were blocked, and I'd been warned in Bolivia by other bikers, you know, you're not going to get through. And I thought, well, I'll go and see if I can get through. And there are roadblocks, and there's barbed wire and burning tires and people standing around with rocks in their hands. And, you know, they're not going to let anybody through. And, you know, I had advice beforehand as to how to handle myself, and it was really good advice. You know, I'd always stop the bike, turn off the engine, take off my helmet, take off my sunglasses, get off the bike and walk over to the people with my hand out saying, you know, how are you? And explain a bit about myself and sort of diffuse the situation. And that worked every single time. But your poverty point, the thing about these people, and it was a political demonstration, they were angry that the president of the country had been impeached by Congress in Lima, and they saw that as an attack on them. But overwhelmingly, these were just poor people, and you could see it. They weren't sophisticated political agitators. They weren't communists or libertarian free marketeers or that. They were just poor, and they just felt that in life we haven't had a good deal. And seeing that kind of again and again, and then with some migrating people in Central America, yes, it is upsetting. And you do realise that whatever problems I have, and I don't have many, and whatever difficulties there are back home, these people are so much
worse. It's a whole other level of
dysfunction,
isn't it?
It's a whole other level. Yeah, it is, absolutely.
And Camille, you mentioned the migrations. So you went to a place, the Darien Gap, they call it, is it? And we people might have read pieces about it recently as well. There's been a flurry of stuff about it. So explain it. This is kind of a lawless jungle area between South and Central America.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I suppose just to say there's no road that links South America and Central America. So you can't trundle along on your bike or whatever it is you're on. Darien is a province in southern Panama. And it's actually linked to these islands in a strange way. There was a kind of a South Sea bubble moment when a bunch of Scottish investors in the 1700s wanted to create a port there. Anyway, it all went belly up and it collapsed the Scottish economy, as a result of which Scotland joined England to make the UK. It's an extraordinary episode in history. But anyway, today, yes, this is a hole between South America and Central America. And there is part of the Caribbean called the Gulf of Darien. And when I came into Colombia, a diplomat said, we're hearing things about refugees, migrants massing up in a seaside village called Necloclí. And I thought, I want to see this. So I went there. And it's quite extraordinary. There's a beach and there are 1,000 people every single day gather on that beach. And they're from Venezuela, Haiti and other places in Latin
China
America.
Well.
And China, which really knocked me off my perch. And I spoke to the UN Office for Migration, who have an operation there to try and advise people and help them. And they said, yes. 75% of the people coming to us at the moment are from China. And I believe they're flying into Ecuador and coming up. Why they're doing this, I'm not sure. But these people, they get in ferries, they go across the Gulf of Darien, they land on the north shore of what is still Colombia in a place called Capargana, and then they walk through the jungle into Panama. I couldn't go that full distance with them because of the motorbike which I'd left behind me. But I know now that some of them die. There were a lot of young women. They had babies in pouches on their sitting on their tummies. There were kids in flip-flops. There were belongings in black plastic bags. And there were people pulling, you know, the little suitcases you have on wheels to get on Ryanair for your weekend break? People had their belongings in those and they were heading off into the jungle.
Through this impassable kind of jungle, basically.
Not impassable.
And everyone along the way kind of ripping them off as well, aren't they?
There's a bit of that, yeah. I mean, there's a bit of people setting up stalls in Colombia and selling them stuff they need, like black plastic bags and flip-flops and such like. But yes, in the jungle, they are attacked from time to time. When I was in Texas much later, I saw a documentary on CNN where a reporter had gone with them right into the jungle. And there were bodies, decomposing bodies that had been people who were attacked by bandits and killed. So it's pretty horrific, but lots do get through. And I met different migrants then at a reception centre in Panama, and then more migrants again, different people in Mexico. So I was trying to, if you like, follow the story, if not the same individuals, right up to the border with the United States.
Camille, you mentioned the rubbish everywhere is kind of a feature as well. Climate change in general would be on your mind going through South and Central America as well, yeah?
It comes up fairly regularly. It came up, first of all, in southern Chile, in that central valley area from a place called Puerto Montt, between Puerto Montt and Santiago. It's the great agricultural food-producing area of Chile, all the fruit and vegetables and all the vineyards and that are in that area. And they are suffering forest fires and they're suffering from drought. I think Chile at the moment is in its 15th or 16th year of drought, one after the other. And in Santiago now, when I was there, I don't know about now, they have water rationing. And you see, as you're heading up through Chile, the Andes are on your right to your east and the Pacific is on your left to the west. And all the rivers that come off the Andes cross that plain. And so you're crossing those rivers. And the road, the river beds may be 200-300 metres wide. And the river in it is almost like a trickle. So you know something's wrong. that trickle of water did not create that riverbed. And it's because of an absence of snow, an absence of rain. And the wine producers in Chile are now having to cope with this and having to think long term of where are we going to get our water from, etc. So that's very much there. And then at the far end, up in Canada, there were lots of forest fires.
On the upside in terms of the natural environment, tell me about the Galapagos.
The Galapagos were wonderful. And I wore this T-shirt especially for you. It's got a big iguana on it.
Oh, an iguana, yeah.
I was in Ecuador, and I just thought I can't come home without doing a little sidebar.
It's the kind of trip of the lifetime for a lot of retirees as well, isn't it? Yeah.
So the largest city in Ecuador is called Guayaquil, and I was there, and I met a fellow there, a lovely fellow, Michael, who ran a hostel, and he said, "Look, you got to go there." And so I left the bike with Michael, got a ticket, and. It's quite extraordinary. It is an ecosystem that is sort of ring fenced. You know, your belongings are sprayed before you're allowed to go there, in order that any bugs or insects you're bringing that would upset the existing ecosystem on the islands isn't brought in. And the first thing that hit me when I got off the plane and I'm walking across the apron to go into the terminal building, and there's a little flower bed, and there's this creature there, and I thought it's a little statue, it's a kind of welcome tourist thing, but it was a live iguana sitting there just looking at everybody. They sit very still and the eyes are moving rapidly. There are animals everywhere on the Galapagos, sea lions, frigate birds, extraordinary beautiful birds in the skies that hover and swoop, and they're just a delight to watch. Snorkeling, you find the turtles. And you find the hilariously named blue-footed booby bird.
Yes, the famous mating dance of the blue-footed booby.
Yeah, and apparently the name booby comes from a Spanish word for silly, because they have this very funny walk where they lift their feet in a very exaggerated gesture.
And are the animals all coexisting okay with the tourists and all
that? They seem to be, yeah. And in the couple of places I stayed on, Isabela and Santa Cruz and San Cristobal, you know, there were tourist places, there were backpacker places. I suppose overwhelmingly the tourists are actually of my generation, the retirees. And yes, you're wandering around and there's benches along promenades by the sea and everything. And if nobody's sitting on the benches, you'll find a sea lion will take the place on the bench and sit there in the sunshine snoozing.
Magic.
Unbothered by us, which is lovely. And I asked people about this, and the only explanation I could get was that hunting is absolutely banned, and you're not allowed to touch the animals, no matter how friendly. You should not touch the animals. So as a result of that, they don't feel threatened by us.
They don't know what we're like, really.
Yeah, that's right.
So America then. Give me a sense of being on the road in America, because I suppose that is the big romantic dream and everything, isn't it? And what are the kind of characters you meet there? Bikers and off-the-grid types and all that?
Lots of Harleys. I'm not a Harley man, but there'll be lots of Harleys and guys cruising, and they're like flying armchairs. They're sitting back and it's like, "Hi, man," you know, and it's so there's all of that. The whole gun culture is very, very prominent.
Yeah, you went to a gun show.
Went to a gun show in Tucson, and, you know, met lovely people who are really friendly and really chatty. And there's a kind of madness there as well, that they're so into these guns. There were displays, rows and rows, all neatly laid out, you know, rifles pointing out, AR-15s and AR-10s, rifle, all down a table, looking really symmetric and lovely. And you think the killing power in this, and bullets everywhere, and handguns, Glock pistols, you know, these things we know from, you know, gang warfare and what have you, all for sale. Young fellas wandering around, you know, some in their teens, some in their early 20s, and you just wonder what's your outlook on life that you're...
And what was the sense you got of them and their outlook on life?
Well, the sense I got, first of all, they're very nice people. They're very hospitable. They're very friendly. You know, if I'd said to any of them, "Listen, I'm stuck for a bed for the night," they would have all said to me, "Oh, come back to my place. You know, it'd be lovely to have you meet my wife," whatever. So they're kind and they're generous and they're open. But the gun thing is, there's an irrationality there. I had a long conversation with one man in which I, you know, said, "Look, there isn't another country on the planet that has mass school shootings, mass supermarket shopping mall shootings kind of every other week. You know, why is it in America? And this guy looked at me absolutely straight and said, it's because we got more freedom. And you sort of think at that point, you know, let's change the subject, because yeah. I'm not going to convince him of anything, and he's certainly not going to convince me. And that's, I think that's really sad. And I'm not sure what the figures are. I had them there the other day. I think it's 40,000 people die in the US every year from guns, and about half of those are suicide. So there's something over 20,000 are dying, you know, in violent incidents through guns.
Yeah, so they were reasonable people in one way, and nice people.
They are, yeah.
You said in general, though, you found America's quite angry, yeah?
In general, yeah. I think there's a great anger in the United States, and it's kind of everybody's angry with everybody else. The liberals are angry with the conservatives and vice versa, and the metropolitan elites think the rednecks are lunatics. It's all of that sort of stuff. It's name-calling. Dismissing whole sections of society or whole schools of opinion with slogans, you know, like rednecks or like gun lunatics or whatever, rather than trying to talk through problems. And I don't know how that's going to play out in November, but it's part of the political narrative that's there at the moment between the Republican Party, which is now completely taken over by Trump and his supporters, and the Democrats.
People got nicer as you went north?
They did, yeah. In Northern California, lovely, lovely people. I mean, just one incident, I stopped the bike in a place called Gualala, which is in Northern California. I'm outside a supermarket, and I'm either loading the bike or I'm getting off, I can't remember. And this guy's looking at me, and we start talking, and he has a bike. And anyway, very quickly, he says, look, come back to my place and have a meal. You can have a bed for the night. And I'm kind of thinking, which one of us is the axe murderer, you know? But I go back, and it's absolutely delightful. I mean, a lovely man, lovely wife, lovely neighbours. And that sort of thing, as one went north, people seemed to me to become more moderate, more tolerant. And then when you hit Canada, it's just lovely. I mean, the people there are so, so nice in British Columbia and Alberta. And to be in a place with really lovely people and stunning, incredible scenery. I mean, the Canadian Rockies, just they really do take your breath away.
Yeah. And then the Yukon Territory, as it used to be called when I was a kid, and Alaska and all that.
Yeah.
Huge romance there.
There is. And for me, you know, just like crossing over the border into the Yukon and that sign, I was almost like a child with giddy excitement. You know, this was, you know, hey, I'm Jack London. Where's the gold rush?
And there's still vast open spaces and huge wilderness up there, yeah?
The Yukon is, I think it's about the size of France. I did look this up in square kilometre terms. I think it's similar to France. There are basically two main settlements, Dawson City up in the north central and Whitehorse. There are 43,000 people, I think, living in the entire province of the Yukon, and 30,000 odd of them are living in Whitehorse. So the rest is largely empty. And you can be riding for hours and hours and hours and hours and see not another person, not another vehicle, and just feel that I'm being embraced by the landscape. You know, I'm seeing incredible rivers, incredible lakes, incredible forests. And I'm just at one with it. And that's, you know, back to your original question about biking and doing it on your own. Yeah. It is magic.
The book is partly dedicated to your geography teacher, Ian Broad.
Yeah.
In fact, you brought some of his ashes.
I did. Ian had a big influence on my life when I was in school. And I think he built on a love of the landscape that I would have got from my mother. And Ian was a very pioneering geography teacher in that he brought us on field trips. He brought us potholing to Clare and to Fermanagh. He brought us up into the Wicklow Mountains. I can remember going up in Glendalough with him and looking for galena, the base metal of lead, and looking for garnets, you know, where the granite and the mica schist meets and all of that. So he really brought a subject alive. And unfortunately, he died from COVID in the middle of all of this, and his sister Pam gave me some of his ashes, And I knew, you know, when she did that, that I just had to bring those with me. And so I scattered them at the Perdido Moreno Glacier near El Calafate in southern Argentina. And I did it because it was so beautiful. It was so dramatic. Ian had taught us all about glaciation, and the place itself was presented to tourists in a very educational way. There were a lot of information explaining what was happening in the landscape, and I thought, this is appropriate.
Yeah, and he probably never saw a glacier in his life, and there he is up there now. Fantastic. Texter wondering, do you speak Spanish or other languages? How did you navigate communication?
I did a course in the Cervantes Institute before I went, and I had a very tiny smattering, but it's one of the lessons of the trip that you can blunder along. You know, you can get quite a distance with just a few words, probably appalling grammar. Yeah. And making a complete idiot of myself. But it was never a big, big problem. I could manage it.
But take off the helmet and smile to them with an open look to you. Okay. Did you get what you needed out of it, or you don't know?
I'm doing I'm going to Scotland in a couple of days with two pals. And in June, I'm going up to the North Cape at the top of Norway. And it's a long run, but it's all very doable, and there'll be no rough roads and there'll be no danger. But it'll be wonderful to be on the top of the world.
How does your wife feel about all this?
She's extremely tolerant.
Okay.
she's okay with it. She's okay. But yeah, she misses me, and she and the children worried about it, but they didn't block me from doing it, thank God.
Okay.
Can I just say, if people are interested, there's two little dates on April the 27th. I'll be in Tertulia Bookshop in Westport Quay at 7 o'clock, talking about this and maybe showing a few pictures. And then the Hinterland Festival in Kells in Meath on June the 30th at 3:30. I'll be doing the same.
Okay, and listen, don't go down a rabbit hole here now, right? But there are lots of people asking about the type of bike and how big.
Okay. It's a BMW. It's called an R1200 GS Adventure. So if you Google that, you'll find out everything about it.
And a massive fuel tank was one of the main
33 litres. Just say to me, it's the one that Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman did the long way round.
Okay, and now made famous by Peter Murta. All right. The book is called From Tip to Top. It's published by Gill Books. Peter Murta, thank you for transporting it. That saved me now, that whole journey. I feel I've done it. We'll take a break.